A princess who pricks her finger on a spinning wheel, a curious boy who climbs a beanstalk, a brave knight who slays a dragon. These stories soothe us to sleep and teach us life lessons. But what if there's more to it than that? What if some of our most cherished fairy tales are true? You are listening to You Totally Made That Up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up, but they're all true. Even though we like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, ooh, creepy, spooky, we like those when they have those type of elements. So those parts may only be true to the people who live them. Still though, we don't go for the lore says or the legend goes. We want dates and names and all the facts that we can find. And my name is Nash.
My name is Tiff.
And we are your hosts. And keep listening till after the stories are done to hear how to get a hold of us. You'll hear an outro that tells you all the social medias and the email address. And we love hearing from you guys. And speaking of that, I sent it to Tiff already, so she has seen it. The most recent spooky snack. There's going to be an episode before you hear this episode. But the most recent spooky snack was for Easter time, and it was about rabbits. And you're going to have to go and listen to it to know what I'm talking about. But bless the listener who has sent us in a trash rabbit. There may be more to come by the time this episode airs. So thank you in advance for those of you who are working on your own trash rabbits. But my goodness, the one that we've already gotten is great.
I was so delighted to see that. Oh my gosh.
So it's probably... like I say, we're recording this ahead of time. Probably you will have already seen it on social media, but we are. Please, that's what we're here for. That's what the whole outro is about, giving you all that contact information so that you can send us treasures such as that trash rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And send us your stories. You know, if you've got crazy, weird hometown or family stories, we like hearing those too. We feature those in Spooky Snacks or, you know, it's just suggestions for things.
Yeah, we appreciate it all. And I'm gonna say that the challenge has no end date, so continue making trash rabbits.
That's exactly right. Any creation that you want to make that we've mentioned in any episode at any point, like you say, there's no due date. There's no stopping.
Yeah.
Anytime. We also have to take a moment to share this awesome email that we got regarding that episode you'll have heard by now, the best of for our anniversary. And we are doing it by way of the magic of editing because, see, we did this episode that you're about to hear before the anniversary episode came out, and then we got the email after we recorded this, so now we're going back and editing it in because we loved it. It made our day.
It so did. It's so lovely.
Congratulations on 1 year. I've loved your podcast since the first listen, and it immediately became my favorite listen to while doing my Saturday morning chores. I've never liked cleaning until now, but it's become one of my favorite times of the week. I wish you had more frequent episodes. One every other week is not enough. Fortunately for me, at least in this situation, I have a terrible memory, so I can go back and listen to past episodes, and it's almost like hearing it for the first time. Keep it up, ladies. You bring me smiles and laughter every week. You definitely spark joy, so I'll be keeping you around for some time. And that's from Jeanette from upstate New York, aka COVID-19's Playground. That's how she signed it off. So, Jeanette, you are fantastic. That was so kind of you to take time to write to us and tell us that. And we appreciate it so very much.
You have sparked joy for us.
That's right. So, okay, we like to jump right into it. And this episode is all about the truth behind some fairy tales, what actual people and events could have or did inspire the stories. And we thought we'd kick off with an overview on what exactly fairy tales are. And here's the gist of what we gathered. Fairy tales are a subset of folk tales and legends and lore and whatnot on the literary Venn diagram overlapping with the ones that have supernatural-esque elements to them, but what distinguishes them is their association with children and that the subject matter tends to lean more magical and whimsical. Something in common with other lore is that lots of them do act as cautionary tales, which we've discussed those in past episodes. But at the same time, many of them are just for funsies. There's not a whole lot of depth. And they can be scary and sad. I mean, good Lord, read the original Little Mermaid if you don't believe me. And hell, you know, Little Red Riding Hood alone, my stars. I mean, a wolf ate her granny. So yeah, while there's romance and heroics, there's also murder, kidnapping. They can get a little gruesome. We could go on, but we're not. You get the idea. And we've actually got four stories for you today. They're all, you know, on the short side. So in terms of format, instead of one of us going and the other going, we're going to kind of go back and forth. And Tiff is going to get us started with one of the most famous fairy tales of them all.
Yes, indeed I am. So jumping right in here, we've got Snow White. And as we most commonly know, it is the story of a vain evil queen who orders her beautiful stepdaughter to be killed. She is, of course, spared. She moves in with the seven dwarves, and then she's revived after being poisoned by true love's kiss. The Grimm version varies on a few points, but that's where we keep ending up, really. So this idea about this beautiful princess and the poisoning and the evil stepmother did not just pop into their heads out of nowhere. In fact, they were likely inspired and combined the stories of two very real women. The first being Margareta von Waldeck of Waldeck, Germany. She was born in 1533, and as in the fairy tale, her mother died when she was very young, and she ended up with a stepmother who was not very fond of children. Margareta came from a noble family, and they owned several mines in the area. Now, unfortunately, many of the openings in the tunnels for these mines were so small that only children could work in them, and Margareta was obviously spared that. And at about the age of 16 or 17, she was sent off to Brussels to be married off for political alliances. One of her suitors was actually Philip II of Spain. And it was very, very sweet. They actually did seem to fall in love. It was genuine. But their marriage was not allowed, as it didn't really meet the requirements from Philip's family for a political alliance. She continued waiting for a few years, but she ended up never being married. She died at the age of 21, and based on some of her symptoms, the shakiness of her handwriting pre-death, it was believed that she was actually poisoned. So that's pretty sad.
But, okay, I have to go back to the mine.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I don't, because it was a stupid comment that I was about to make. Well, it wasn't so stupid. Look, it was worked out in my head. It was, and then as soon as it came, it went. It was something about whistling while they worked.
Well, there's mines in the second part, too. You can always wedge it in there.
Okay, well, and if my brain fart dissipates, maybe the joke will come back. I feel like it was a good one. I really do. Okay. I feel like it was a real zinger, but carry on.
Okay. Now, as far as the second story, it seems that they melded Margareta's story with that of Maria Sophia Margareta Katerina von Erth. And, we're just going to call her Maria because
your voice faded out. You were like, blah, 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 Vana.
Oh.
Yeah. You went, it just got tinier and tinier. It went, Vana.
All right. I probably ran out of breath.
Yeah, that's what I think you did. Sorry.
No. Okay, deep breath.
I don't even know what you said, like combine. Okay, yeah. Just yeah. Wherever all you right. Were, like, combined it with Maria.
All right, so Maria Sophia Margareta Katerina von Erthel, which is too many names to combine and say, so we're going to call her Maria. So she was born in 1729 in Lohr, Germany. She is actually a legitimate princess. The region that she's from is known for their glassworks, and they also had quite an abundance of poisonous nightshade that grew in the surrounding forests. Now, Maria also had a stepmother who was once again not fond of her stepchildren, and the most interesting part of her story might be the talking mirror that was in their castle.
You have my attention.
Yeah. So this mirror is believed to have been a gift from Maria's father, Philip. We just keep coming up with these same names. Philip gave this talking mirror to the stepmother, And because of the smoothness of the glass and the way the mirror was built, it's actually a trick mirror. And so voices reverberate from it when you speak to it. So the woman, you know, she would be looking in her mirror and say, "You're so beautiful." And it would kind of echo back to her. So it was like she was hearing another voice talking to her. There's also a bit of etching in the corner of the mirror that translates as self-love. So there's a lot of vanity, I would say, associated with the mirror. But I think that that's also really interesting that the glass works, that they had a technology like that at the time. And of course, how it ended up being folded in with the fairy tale as we know it. There's nothing that indicates that Maria was poisoned or that she had died young, but another interesting fact about her story that combines with Margareta's is that there are mining hills in their region. And the miners, again, were children because of the small passages. Now, the children in these mines also wore bright caps so that they could be found easier in case of collapse. So, I mean, if everybody's thinking like I am this whole time to the Disney version of Snow White that we all know about, all of the dwarves have their different colored hats that they wore through the mines, the dwarves, the children, you know, you kind of see how things go there. And a lot of these children, because they were climbing in and out of these holes, ended up with a lot of deformities and inhibited growth. So they ended up all remaining pretty small through their relatively short lives. Lastly, both of these young ladies were known for their beauty, and it was a huge reason why Count von Waldeck sent Margareta to Brussels to be wed off and not one of his other daughters. And as far as Maria, there's actually a commissioned portrait of her. And so you can see in that portrait where a lot of, you know, the Snow White beauty that we know of to this day, she's got very dark hair, very, you know, porcelain, very light skin. She's got the rosy lips, a little bit of blush in her cheeks. She was a very, very beautiful young woman. So, of course, you piece together a little bit here, a little bit there, and you have quite a compelling story about a vain, evil queen, beautiful stepdaughter, and then, you know, it kind of just goes from there in a very soap opera type of fashion. And that's Snow White. That's really how that whole fairy tale came to be, combining two beautiful young German ladies and their stories, which were absolutely true. They were both real. They both died. Of course, they died. It would be amazing if they didn't. Oh my God.
If they were still alive, this would be a very different story. Yes.
It would be a very different episode. But there you go. That's Snow White for you. Did that joke ever come back to you?
No. No. And especially after you talked about deformed mining children, I feel like it's...
You're going to hold off?
It's inappropriate, whatever it was. I'm going to file it under. That was a good thing that I dodged a bullet. Well, I'm now going to tell you the backstory behind Hansel and Gretel. And to refresh your memory, this story was first published in 1812 and comes to us courtesy of the Brothers Grimm, again, who we will actually, we're going to tackle them in another episode that we have planned for the future. And the story is about a pair of siblings who stumble upon a house made of gingerbread and covered in sweet treats. The witch who lives in said house thinks they'd make for a good dinner, and they end up killing her. Nice. And of course, the lesson is, don't trust strangers, especially ones offering candy. Turns out that during the mid-17th century in Germany, there was indeed a murder of a witch, and it was over something incredibly important, a really awesome gingerbread recipe. I mean, we've all been there, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. There was a brother and sister, adults, not kids, who were bakers named Hans and Greta Metzler, and they lived in a village in the Spessart Forest, and Hans was just head over heels for a woman named Katharina Schraderin. Well, sort of. He was a dick. He wanted to marry her to get access to the recipe for that aforementioned gingerbread, and when she shot down his marriage proposal, he accused her of being a witch. Now, briefly, about Katharina, as you probably divined, because I mentioned the gingerbread recipe being hers, she was known for being a damn good baker in her own right, and her particular specialty was that tasty treat, that Lebkuchen, which, by the way, isn't exactly gingerbread, but close enough. And she had mastered her baking skills and invented the recipe when she worked in the kitchen at Quedlinburg Abbey, located several hours outside of Berlin, which was a respectable place. It was founded in 936 by a queen who would later be canonized as Saint Matilda. And it, quote, housed unmarried women and widows from noble families and helped in their education and religious development. So, I mean, it just wasn't quite believable that Katerina was a witch. I assume for many reasons, but that's a primary among them. And she just doesn't fit the witch mold, as it were. And we know this because she's acquitted at her 1647 trial and, smart on her part, she gets the hell out of Dodge and, quote, fled to the woods and built a small house there. Alas, Hans, along with Sister Greta, track her down and they kill her. Then they burn down the house. And presumably, Katerina just had the recipe memorized because before they set the fire, they're searching everywhere for it. And no dice. All they find is a batch of the gingerbread. But hey, better than nothing. So Hans takes that. And when they're back at their bakery, he manages to replicate it well enough. But he doesn't really have time to do anything with it because he gets caught and he's put on trial. But again, he's saying Katerina was a witch, this time throwing in that, oh, and guess what? She was a cannibal witch. And the judge actually buys it.
What?
Yeah. Hans is found not guilty, and he ends up moving to Nuremberg, where, quote, he popularized the city's famous Lebkuchen. Is Nuremberg famous for that? It's just not what I think of when I hear Nuremberg. But all right. I confess that I did not do a deep dive on that topic. So, okay, how do we know all this? There was a book published in 1963 by a Hans Traxler called The Truth About Hansel and Gretel, and he tells about how a teacher and amateur archaeologist named Georg Aussegg went down the proverbial rabbit hole of investigating the Hansel and Gretel story, and that he hit pay dirt. Why didn't Aussegg write it all up himself? Great question, and I'll answer it for you in a minute. But here's what went down with Aussegg. In January of 1945, Aussegg and some of his students went to Hesse to a tiny village called Steinau something something I can't pronounce, and a farmer says that his grandfather had told him he'd actually seen a witch's house in the Spessart Woods, which locals referred to as the Hexenwald, aka Witch's Forest. But he couldn't investigate it at the time, so he goes back home to Prague and doesn't get to come back to the woods until 1962. But in the meantime, he had been studying the Grimm's story as if it were fact, part of that being trying to determine landmarks in order to locate the witch's house, and another part being that, based upon the way the Grimms phrased the witch's dialogue, that, quote, her dialect was typical for Wernigerode, a town in the state of Saxony-Anhalt. He dug into the local archives and found the so-called Wernigerode manuscript, a parchment-bound volume describing the 1647 trial of one Katerina Schraderin, the baker witch. So he had some good leads. It takes him 2 months, but he finds what remains of the house, and, quote, the well-preserved foundations of 4 baking ovens. Inside one of them, he discovered a partially charred female skeleton. Yikes.
Whoa.
He also found the metal front door hinges, because, you know, those wouldn't have burnt up with just the heat from a house fire, and he says that one was broken, so his presumption is that Hans and Greta had busted in. Then, near one of the partially remaining walls, he finds this little tin box that contains some baking tools and, holy moly, the gingerbread recipe. There's tons of pictures from the book that you can see in the Atlas Obscura article that I'll link you to, including the recipe and some of Aussegg while he's excavating the house, and I'll stick a couple in show notes. They're really cool. And boy, howdy, were people excited. The book, quote, caused an uproar. The media picked up the story and turned it into national news. The West German paper, Abendzeitung, said, quote, book of the week? No, it's the book of the year and maybe the century. And it wasn't just big news in Germany. The story went international. Quote, foreign publishers, smelling a profit, began negotiating for the translation rights. School groups, some from neighboring Denmark, traveled to the Spessart Woods in the states of Bavaria and Hesse to see the newly discovered foundations of the witch's house. But then, in early 1964, a snag. See, the author, Traxler, had been published before. He was a children's story writer and a caricaturist, and it came out, in part, because it was noted that Katerina's Lebkuchen recipe was identical to one in a popular cookbook that, well, quote, of course, none of it was true, but the 120-page book contained more than 40 photos, drawings, and models, which made the convoluted tale look quite convincing. Traxler himself posed as Aussegg, clad in a Columbo-like raincoat, a leather hat, sunglasses, fake beard, and mustache. Photographer Peter Von Treskow and I had so much fun taking those photos that sometimes we would find ourselves lying on the ground laughing, Traxler recalled. And guys, they are impressive, seriously. Like I said, I'll have some in show notes. And there's one, it just kills me. It's of the supposed piece of gingerbread that he found, and it's staged in a lab-like setting. And the caption reads, "The radiocarbon dating equipment used for studying the gingerbread was a lasagna pan, a TV cable, a few spice jars, and a microscope." I love it. I absolutely love it. Now, some people refused to accept it, that it was a fake. There's always those. And over the following months, after everything was exposed, the publisher's office had to hire 3 workers expressly for the purpose of going through and replying to all the letters they were receiving from people who wanted to know the truth. And the cops did question Traxler and his cohorts about it. Sounds like they were debating filing fraud charges, but they ended up not doing anything. So yeah, that's the answer to why Ossegg didn't write about his findings, because he didn't exist. But I mean, this book even fooled some academics. Traxler did such a good job. Some people still believe, though. Anyway, I had to tell you that. I'm sorry. I know I deceived you, but you needed to hear that story because I was cracking up about it. When I was looking up, you know, truth behind fairy tale stuff, this just owned me. And y'all know me. I love to slip hoaxes in here sometimes. I will tell you the truth for my next one, though. Cross my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. No, I really will. But I had to tell you that story just in case you come upon it and you think it's real, because it's not real. Okay, what's next?
All right, here we go. We've got the Pied Piper, which I feel, you know, is definitely overlooked a lot. It's not really one that you hear referenced and talked about. And I think it's just because it comes across as so simple, and it is. You know, the Pied Piper saves a town that's infested by rats. But after he's completed the task, they refuse to pay him. So he opts to lure the town's children away in retaliation. And then they're never seen again after they disappear into a hill. In the story, 2 children survived, but they were unable to tell what happened to the other children because one was blind and the other was mute. So, yeah, it's a real dick move. After reading through all of this and coming across this, I was like, holy crap, you know, the Pied Piper is a real bad dude. And I don't feel like that gets discussed enough because we have evil queens as stepmothers and witches to talk about. But there is truth to it. It's more than just a story about bad business. And the truth is interesting and sad and complex. So the real event took place in Hamelin, Germany in 1284. And this is not something that's questioned. There is a lot to actually back that up. We also know that between 100 and 130 children disappeared from the town, and it was most likely on June 22nd or 26th. The rats were actually not part of the story until the 1600s. And this was something that was obviously very tragic for the town because they recorded the incident by creating a stained glass window in Market Church. Now, unfortunately, the church was actually destroyed in 1660, but there are manuscripts that describe the church and the glass well enough that it was recreated. Quote, "A recreation of the window shows the piper in his colorful clothes and several children dressed in white. The date is set by an entry in Hamelin's Town Chronicle, which was dated 1384 and said simply and chillingly, it is 100 years since our children left." So I was trying to come up with ways to kind of order some of these theories and options for what happened, like least to most tragic or something, but there's not really a preferred option. They all kind of suck. They're all horrible. There's one option that the Pied Piper was the devil or a demon, and I get it, but there are just too many facts to support real scenarios, so let's just check that off right away. The least likely one first would be the Black Plague. A lot of people suggest that the children were removed from the town because they were infected, or that they had died because of the infection. And it would be a really good theory, except that the plague didn't hit until the 1300s. And didn't really hit Germany until around 1350, which is well past the date that we know this incident happened. That may, however, be the source of the rats being added to the story because they were believed to have spread the disease. Now, speaking of disease, there's also the idea that the children were stricken with dancing disease, which is known as St. Vitus's dance and is formally known as Sydenham's chorea. Now, this is a disorder that's characterized by rapid, uncoordinated jerking movements, primarily affecting the face, hands, and feet.
Which is exactly what I look like when I dance. Accurate.
Yeah. Now, this affects... I threw my head back in laughter and lost my place because I was imagining like Elaine from Seinfeld kind of dancing. So this is more common in females than in males, and also most common in people below 16 years of age. So some theories have linked the disappearance of the children to mass psychogenic illness in the form of dancing mania. And these dancing mania outbreaks occurred during the 13th century. There was one in 1237 in which a large group of children traveled from Erfurt to Arnstadt, jumping and dancing the entire way.
That's what I was about to ask. The theory is that they just like danced off a cliff like they were lemmings or something. Like, I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. They were struck with this dancing disease and they just.
Someone would have noticed.
They just had to dance.
I doubt this would be classified as a disappearance, a mass disappearance, if they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like, you know, some of those other mass hysteria things where people are dancing or laughing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's not like they all wake up at the same time and do it. It can be gradual and then it kind of increases, but it's all there for people to witness.
Right.
So, yeah, we can check that one off too. There is another historical option that we can go with, and that would be the Children's Crusade. As a history refresher, the Crusades were a series of religious wars between Christians and Muslims, and they were started primarily to secure control of holy sites considered sacred by both of the groups. There were 8 major crusades between 1096 and 1291, and it was a mess. It was a big bloody mess for everybody. The Children's Crusade was never officially sanctioned by the Pope, so it's not on that official list of crusades from the time period. These were self-proclaimed, unarmed crusaders that were children. They were apparently going to Jerusalem to recover the true cross, which had been lost to the Muslims in another battle. But it was just kind of like, we're going to go and do this. And there wasn't a plan. And there's also a question about whether or not it was actually children in this crusade, because the term, the Latin term, pueri, could translate to boys or children. And some people translate it more to servants. So it could have just been a very poor peasants' crusade, as to, you know, that would also explain why they didn't really have weapons, they didn't really have a plan. But they did take off. They wore the insignia just like other crusaders did, and they all took the vow, which was binding to those who were at least 14 years old. And I know, a different time then, you know, by that age people were like already getting married off and expected to bear children soon, but yikes.
Hello there. I'm Erica, your host of the Les Represent podcast. We talk to female-identifying women from all walks and paths of life. We talk about anything. Their experiences, their stories, their projects, their favorite food, even their pets' names. Anything. And what do we all have in common, you ask? Well, we're all queer. And in the world when the media, society, and even our parents are telling us who we are and how to identify, sometimes we just need to speak for ourselves. So sit back, grab a snack, and listen to our conversations. Get to know someone. You might find, regardless of country, generation, or orientation, you might have more in common than you think. Oh, and sometimes my co-host will chime in with something to say. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify.
The whole idea of the Children's Crusade is really kind of interesting, because there were 2 young men. There was a 12-year-old named Stephen, and there was another child named Nicholas, who around the same time both had visions of Jesus, basically telling them, oh, you need to lead people to go to Jerusalem and do this. And Stephen, he took off. He was a poor shepherd kid, but he was like, yeah, Jesus told me to do this. I got to go do it. And he had like, the sources vary. It could be between like 15 to 30,000 followers. And apparently they were all children that all went along with this. And they believed that when they got to the Mediterranean, that the sea was going to part for them and let them on their way. But these 2 groups of crusaders, children crusaders, never even made it that far. If they didn't die from disease or famine or freezing or murder or kidnapping, it just wasn't a great idea for a whole bunch of children to just go wandering across Europe. So a lot of them were kidnapped. They were sold off as slaves. They were murdered. And then they were never seen again. Now, this theory can get written off for a few reasons. The main one, though, is that the Children's Crusade happened in 1212. And of course, we have that evidence from the beginning that tells us that the event from the Pied Piper was 1284. So that's that. A few other short ideas about what happened do include some natural disasters. There may have been a massive landslide or flood which took the children. And of course, these ideas tie in with the story as it's told, with the drowning of the rats and the children being led into the hills never to be seen again. So perhaps the image of the Pied Piper was just another version of death being personified, because a clownish figure leading children to death makes it easier somehow? I don't know. And why not just say that one of those events happened if it was a natural disaster? It wasn't like those things weren't known or recorded before. So I feel like if that actually was what happened, they would have just said, you know, that there had been a landslide or a massive flood. I don't think that there would have been some story and some, you know, tragic stained glass window about.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have been just children.
Right. So now let's get into the last two possibilities, which I feel are the most likely candidates for what really happened. The first one, that there was a large wave of emigration from Hamelin. There were opportunities in other communities, other countries. One that was mentioned a lot was Transylvania, which at the time was part of Hungary and also had been founded and built up by a lot of Germans. So maybe there was family there that they were moving to. Essentially, this theory says that the Piper was kind of like a walking billboard or one of those sign spinners, you know, kind of just being like, hey, there's some opportunities out in Hungary. My lord will pay you this much if you relocate and help build up this new location. Why be a peasant in Germany when you can be a peasant in Transylvania? Or however his pitch went. Something like that, I'm sure. And of course, the kids don't really have a choice but to go with the parents. Or if they were old enough, they could have left on their own as apprentices or as servants. And this idea is not very flashy or exciting. But when historians and genealogists look back at many of the records, they find German surnames which appear to have originated in Hamelin or at least the region, and those names are concentrated in other countries. Quote, linguist Jürgen Udolf has performed research suggesting that surnames from Hamelin may have found their way into modern-day Polish phone books, and that the children in the legend were actually citizens of the town who were willing to emigrate, and they were just using children kind of as a general word, not necessarily just meaning small children. And then we've got the most depressing option, that the parents and families sent the children away on purpose. And this isn't just a medieval problem. Many impoverished families still do this to this day. You know, it happens around the world. If you look back just even at American history, think the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, even in the 60s, you know, when the war on poverty and that started getting recognized more, children were being sold off or kind of bargained away to help alleviate families that were really burdened by a lot of these problems with poverty, not having enough money or food or clothes for their families. I'm just going to quote this here because it's a wonderfully worded and depressing summary of this. Quote, the entire business of the rats could be an attempt to wash out the bad memories. It could be a cover-up to draw attention away from the business of the children and make it all so sugar-coated and so mysterious. The rats may be a red herring, but in the medieval mill town of Hamelin, there were certainly a problem, and not the only one. In 1284, at least 90% of the population of this busy town were living in extreme poverty, starving, and struggling to feed their families. So this has led Elke Leibs, a professor in German literature, to an unsettling conclusion about what really happened. From the Middle Ages on, you see these chronicles where the parents send the children away. Like in Hansel and Gretel, all these stories hide the real background, that the parents were glad to get rid of the children. Yikes.
But you're right. Immediately, my mind flashed to the Great Depression and people essentially selling their children. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the Pied Piper, the town, they have like this big festival. It's like a really big thing in the town every year. People get dressed up. They have like Lots of, they definitely go all in on the tourist attraction that is the Pied Piper in Hamelin. But yeah, so I thought that that was kind of neat. Lots of history about the Pied Piper. I mean, it's a legitimate event. What exactly happened wasn't recorded all that well, but we do know that something happened. And I think that there are some pretty decent theories.
Yeah, I think if they were that impoverished, and then I think, yeah, the last two that some noble people sent an emissary to say, hey, you know, you'll get, I don't know, whatever their currency was, you'll get $5 on the spot for every well-bodied child that's old enough to work.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah, I think that's it. But all in all, the story of the Pied Piper, it's a real dick.
It's depressing. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you have for us? Hopefully that's maybe less depressing.
It is. I think it is. There's elements of it, but there's a sweet spot.
All right, good.
And it's true. Again, I was a lying liar last time.
Uh-huh.
But cross my heart, this is true. We now move on to the real life Beauty and the Beast.
Ooh.
As far as the story goes, to remind you, here's the summary for the translated version of the original, which I'm linking for you in show notes. And actually, there's going to be links to all of the full texts of the stories that we're covering back at show notes. And so, quote, while returning home to his family, a merchant plucks a rose from a garden and is confronted by the beast, who demands that the merchant send him one of his daughters in payment for his theft. As the rose was meant to be a gift for his daughter Beauty, she volunteers to go to the beast. Once she arrives in the beast's castle, she begins to have a recurrent dream in which a handsome prince beckons her. She wonders who he is and what his connection is to the beast. Beauty's questions are answered when she learns not to trust appearances. So the original, La Belle et la Bête, was written by Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve, and it was actually more novel length. Then after she died, a Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont published a short version in 1756 and didn't credit Villeneuve like a jerk, but that shorter version is the common one that we think of today. However, could it be that the original author, Villeneuve, got inspiration from a true story? Some historians speculate that she just may have. And so, I take you to France, 1547, to the court of King Henri II. And His Majesty has just been sent a very interesting gift from Spain, a 10-year-old boy. But this was no ordinary boy. He was, on sight, very unique, and that's because he had hypertrichosis, which is a condition that causes excessive hair growth all over the body. And I mean thick, copious amounts of hair, and all over the body, face, arms, the whole shebang. And scientists have since discovered that it's caused by a mutated gene that can be passed along to offspring. It's incredibly rare. Matter of fact, there's only about 100 documented cases in the world. And regarding this child, the condition, quote, gave him the appearance of being a werewolf-like creature, and he was treated like a freak of nature. At the time, people believed in a legend of wild men, which are a lot like the legend of Sasquatch. They believed that this boy was a child of one of these wild men, and that he was some sort of human-ape hybrid monster. Now, King Henri was known for his love of collecting oddities, not my word, end quote. It was even a symbol of wealth and status for royals to own dwarves as court jesters. And we actually talked about stuff like that in the episode called Family Forks. You must check it out because my lord, that was a ride. But for whatever reason, Henri didn't think of him as a monster or as someone to entertain him. Ultimately, he really took a liking to the kid. Having said that, initially, he was definitely more of a curiosity. And they didn't know what to do with him at first because he wouldn't talk to them. Quote, at that time, the boy could not speak, even when they tried to communicate with him in Spanish. He was clearly a feral child who was abandoned because of his condition. He most likely spent his life being feared by people and put on display in chains. The king ordered the creature to be taken to the dungeons, and his physicians went to study him more closely.
The creature.
I know. The creature and the dungeon and the very dramatic. And in another place, I didn't go down this road. There's also thoughts that he was just kind of this servant passed around. Like, again, a situation where the parents didn't know what to do with him. And so he was farmed out. So the thing about lived his life in chains and was feral is a little dramatic. In any event, as it turned out, as time passed, they found out that he was able to say something, his name, which was Pedro Gonzalez. The physicians reported back their assessment, which was that this was a normal child, minus the hairiness, and that he was just really shy and scared. So King Henri decided that this was going to be a project. He wanted to see if he could basically culture Pedro up. To start, he was renamed something the king thought sounded more regal, and from that point on, he was known as Petrus Gonsalves.
So they're basically giving him a makeover.
They're absolutely, this is extreme makeover werewolf edition. I guess.
I'm just imagining the montage, you know, changing clothes, posing.
The curtains open, he's in a new outfit.
Yep.
You know, his hair's done. Actually, in like in Beauty and the Beast, you know, when they're fluffing him up and sometimes he's got bows in his hair and sometimes he's... That's exactly it, yeah.
Uh-huh.
End quote. Rather than lock him in a cage, the king gave him a classical gentleman's education. From military tactics to Latin, Gonsalves learned everything a young nobleman should. In fact, he was more educated than some of the aristocracy themselves. They dressed him the part, too. I mean, he was decked out. Like you said, it was extreme makeover. And there's several paintings of him, one of which will be in show notes. So you can check this. I mean, it's not. I mean, he's really dudeed up just as much as the paintings that you see of royalty and nobility. About how smart he was, quote, his tutors were impressed with how intelligent he actually was, and they all grew to like him. And King Henri's wife, Queen Catherine de Medici, adored Petrus as well. She was on board with all of this, and her support continued after King Henri died and she assumed the throne. One thing noted about the queen was that she was also into matchmaking. She did it all the time with people in the court. And now that Petrus was old enough to marry, she wanted to make it happen. Now, daughters of noblemen were out. Even the queen couldn't make that happen, not without potentially alienating someone prominent. So she starts interviewing gals from families of lower social status. And she finds a daughter of one of the servants, this stunning woman, who also happened to be named Catherine. The queen, though, didn't allow her to meet Petrus until their wedding day. And can you just imagine her shock? I can't.
Yeah, that's rough.
But she had no choice. This was an order from the queen. So in essence, she was captive. We don't have documentation like journals or something to know precisely how things progress, but we do know about Petrus's character. One of my sources describing him as, quote, a gentle, intelligent man who never hurt a fly. What we do know for sure is that they had many children, and more on them in a second. And here's a very interesting tidbit. There's a portrait of Petrus and Catherine, and it'll be in show notes, and it has a somewhat unique element to it. Quote, Catherine's hand is on Petrus's shoulder. According to sociological historians, that sort of gesture was not always present in images of couples, and it would have signified that they actually were in love.
Aww.
So about the kids. The first two were healthy baby boys, no hairiness. And there was a third who also didn't carry the trait. But the remaining four, Antoinetta, Francesca, Enrico, and Madalena, did inherit the hypertrichosis. The queen commissioned many portraits of the family, minus the non-hairy children, and she would give them as gifts to other royal families and nobilities because, quote, the queen wanted to keep up the appearance that this was a successful experiment in taming the wild man and giving birth to hybrid children. They were given a pretty luxurious life. Just like Petrus, the kids were well-fed and well-dressed and well-educated. On the other hand, it's important to remember that while they weren't locked away in a dungeon or a tower or something like in the Beauty and the Beast fairy tale, they were, in a way, prisoners. They were owned by the queen. And this is driven home by the fact that Antoinetta was given to a noble family in Bologna, and Madalena and Enrico were also given or possibly sold to other noble families. But there's not much documentation about what happened with them. There's more sketches and doctor's notes and such on Antoinetta, though. In any event, in 1589, there was some sort of coup, and quote, the Gonsalves family found themselves without a benefactor. During the turmoil, they caught the attention of the Duke of Parma, who sent Gonsalves and his family to his home city. The Duke died before he could join them, but his wife, Margaret, the Duchess of Parma, immediately took the family under her wing. So they live out the rest of their lives in Italy under the patronage of the Duchess. Historians have documentation of their life there and that several of the children went on to get married and have children of their own, including one of the daughters with hypertrichosis, and it's noted some of her children carried the gene as well. And it's in church records that Petrus was present for the baptism of his grandchildren, and there's records about the death and burial of Catherine Gonsalves. Sadly, we don't have the same regarding Petrus, and historians speculate that this is because he wasn't allowed to have a proper Christian burial since, quote, animals did not get the same sacraments as humans.
Oh,
I know. It's heartbreaking. So while he was royalty adjacent, Petrus never turned into a prince, and though he was beloved, he still died a beast. And that is your true story behind Beauty and the Beast.
You know, I think that it's really nice that there was actual love in that story. Even if it wasn't, you know, the sweeping romantic Beauty and the Beast story that we're familiar with, I think that there was genuine care for, you know, the Beast, heavy quotations, because that's no way to treat somebody with that genetic anomaly. But I'm glad that there was at least some tenderness for their lives.
Exactly. I did like that little detail about the portrait. And hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, it wasn't, you know, the queen's doing.
Mm-hmm.
That she wanted it posed that way because she was so adamant about only the, I almost said the furry children. I'm going to hell. That she only wanted those children in the portraits instead of the whole family. I do think, though, based on what was written about his character, it doesn't smack of him being some asshole, you know, we're going to have sex. We're going to have kids. Like, I mean, they had, what did I say, 5, 6 kids? So, I'm like you. My inclination is to think, to hope that there was something there. So I'm looking at the time. We're going to be a little short. So do you want a bonus round?
Let's do it.
I have an extra here for just such an occasion, but it's creepy, so.
I like creepy.
All right. Let's talk about the folktale turned fairy tale of Bluebeard. And we'll get to that kind of tenuous categorization in a second. The most popular version is by Charles Perrault from 1697, though there's many versions of the tale. The Brothers Grimm did one called The Robber Bridegroom that may ring bells for y'all. And the one that I highly recommend is Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber. It is excellent. So here's the basics. It's about this prominent wealthy nobleman nicknamed Bluebeard. I read both that his beard was actually blue or that it was so black it kind of shined with a blue tinge, but whatever, doesn't matter. The story goes that he was basically marrying women back to back and that his wives weren't dying, they were disappearing. But he still keeps landing chicks, and with each wife, he's apparently gone through the same routine. He gives them a set of keys and is like, this is the key to the room with a stash of furniture if you want to redecorate. This is the key to the room where the jewels are. This is one for the room with the extra cash, blah, blah, blah. But this little key to the closet downstairs, don't ever use it. Don't ever go into that room.
Oh, I'm in there.
Right? That's, yeah. And so then he goes, okay, bye. I'm going on a long journey. Well, yeah. So what the hell do you think is going to happen? Most recent wife's curiosity gets the better of her, and she opens the door, and it's just this blood-spattered room where the bodies, and some places say it's just the heads, of all the former wives are hung up on hooks. Now, he catches her because the key was bleeding, and he's all, get ready, you about to join the club. But she puts him off saying, give me some time to say my final prayers, and he agrees. She somehow gets word to her sister, who gets help, and the wife is rescued just in time.
That's good.
Folklorist Bruno Bettelheim is on the same page as I am that this just barely makes the cut as a fairy tale. Because remember, we talked about that at the top, what makes a fairy tale, how the element of magic is a distinguishing element. Anyway, his stance is, quote, Bluebeard can only be considered a fairy tale because of the magical bleeding key. Otherwise, it would just be a monstrous horror story. It's never said why Bluebeard killed the first wife or why he kept the head and set up this secret room, but the thought by some scholars is that the whole thing with the subsequent wives was less about them discovering the evidence of the murders and more about not being subservient and obedient and trustworthy, that they disobeyed his orders. So I guess the moral here is a curiosity killed the cat sort of thing? Question mark? I mean, I would submit, maybe, if at all possible, not marrying a dude whose wives keep disappearing. I would think that that's the lesson, but okay. There's two real-life dudes who are supposedly inspiration, and who boy. First up, Gil de Rais. One article on him starts out with a bang, so I will too. Quote, In France, Gilderay is remembered both for his service as a war hero with the French army and for murdering more than 100 children. Welp.
At least they, you know, positive and negative. They're weighing things out there.
Yeah, there's a balance. Now, I'm not going to get into detail on old Gil here, not just for time's sake, but also because he's earmarked for another episode. But suffice to say, he was a real piece of work. And I'll be honest, as far as the inspiration goes, I'm not quite tracking with it unless it's just that he disappeared kids over the course of many years, like how Bluebeard disappeared wives, and then it was found out that they were both serial killers. That's the only connection I personally can make. The one that seems closer is this other one, Connemore the Accused. And with a name like that, I mean, here's the deal on Connemore. He was a king. He ruled the area now known as Brittany in France, and the story goes that he became king, he was at the time a count, by murdering the then ruler named Jonas. Then he marries Jonas's wife, but she pieces out because he tries to kill her. So she goes to the Frankish court where her son Judael is just to get away from him. She apparently dies in the not-so-distant future. I'm not clear on that, but that's my assumption because shortly after that, he marries a gal named Tréfine. Now, Tréfine was the daughter of the Count of Vannes, with whom Connemore had beef, and initially she was all, hell no, I'm not marrying you, because he was well known for just murdering people willy-nilly. And he threatens her that he'll escalate the beef to full-out battle, that he'll come after her family. He'll invade their land if she doesn't marry him. Fast forward several years. She ends up having a son, Trémure, and here's where things get a little muddy in terms of how we know about what happens next, what's legend versus fact. But here we go. Connemore supposedly has this vision or was told a prophecy that he would be overthrown by his son. So he killed Tréfine and Trémure and continued to kill wives and or mistresses if they got pregnant. He also was apparently technically the king regent for a young nephew because, you know, the kid was too young to take the throne. But this may somehow be getting mixed in with that stepson of the king that he killed, the one that I mentioned earlier, Jonas, since he technically would have had the throne. That is, the son, Judael, would have had the throne. So essentially, amongst other things, Connemore was putting out hits or whatever on Judael to secure the throne for himself. In any event, as one of my sources put it, quote, Connemore was followed by accusations of murder his entire life. So everybody knew that this dude was trash, and there was a prominent figure in Brittany, Samson of Dole, who was later canonized as a saint, who petitioned the local bishops to excommunicate Connemore, which they did, and Samson also convinced Frankish King Childebert to stop supporting Connemore, who had been assigned as the protector of the English Channel, basically stripping him of all his titles and responsibilities or whatever so that he'd be ruler of exactly nothing. And in a lovely bit of irony, the stepson of the murdered king kills Connemore in a later battle. Backing up to Tréfine for a second, there was a tale regarding her murder created by who knows who, but it got passed down, and see if it sounds familiar. While Connemore is away from the castle, Tréfine discovers a secret room filled with, quote, relics of his deceased wives. She prays for their souls, and their ghosts appear to her, warning her that Connemore will kill her if she becomes pregnant, since a prophecy states that he will be killed by his own son. When he returns, he discovers that she is pregnant. Tréfine escapes with magical aid from the dead wives and gives birth in a forest. So then the story goes that Tréfine hides the baby, but Connemore catches up to her, beheads her, and eventually he finds and kills the baby too. Far-fetched, of course, but having said all that, Tréfine is deemed a saint. There's lots of churches in Brittany dedicated to her, and there's actually a village called Saint Tréfine. And going back to what the lesson or moral of the story could be, quote, yet another theory of Bluebeard's origins is centered upon the fairy tales being seen as women's stories passed down through generations from mother to daughter. The story isn't warning against temptation and curiosity, but the practical consequences of marriage. In the time when childbirth was a main cause of death for women, mothers warned their daughters that marriage could be deadly since you could be killed by your husband with the simple act of becoming pregnant by him. In this way, the tale loses its sadistic killer and becomes a tale of normal life. And I mean, okay, because, yeah, a little, wow, yeah. But okay, and as we've discussed in a past episode, the stats do show that the second cause of maternal mortality, coming in behind those issues related to pregnancy and childbirth, is indeed murder, and that the murder is most likely committed by the domestic partner, aka the father of the soon-to-be baby. And, you know, well, I'd like to take this moment to congratulate myself on ending this episode with a real downer.
You know, clap. Slow clap for you, Nash. Bringing joy to us in these hard times.
You're welcome. So let's close out our episode with a quote on fairy tales. Fairy tales are important because they spark the imagination. They give us an outlet for experiencing things in our minds before we experience them in the real world. It is where the troubles of the real world can meet the supernatural and mix things up. In a fairy tale, anything can happen and any kind of creature can exist. And when anything can happen, we can find solutions to the things in our real lives. Through imagination, we learn about our world.
That's lovely.
That's lovely. So yeah, there you go. There's four true stories and one that's supposed to be true, but turns out not so much, behind fairy tales.
I learned things.
I did too.
This was a fun one.
And if you guys have any suggestions for other stuff you want us to tackle, like we said, we like the ones that have some sort of, you know, much like fairy tales, magical, whimsical, supernatural, paranormal. We like the stories that have those elements, but they have to be true. So if you know of stories that have some weird craziness to them, those are the ones we really dig. And actually, when it comes down to it, if it's weird enough, we don't care if it's got, if it doesn't have any ghosts or monsters or something in it. If it's weird, we want it. We want it. We've got lots of stuff planned for y'all. So, you know, there's going to be cults. We haven't done one on cults yet. That's earmarked.
I got invited to join a cult when I was in college.
Well, I want you to save that story.
I will. I'll save it. College was an interesting time.
That's some bonus content right there. Yeah, that's another thing. We have a YouTube channel, so find us over on YouTube. It's linked everywhere. You know, if you go to the blog or whatever, or in our link tree, we'll take you to the YouTube channel, or you can just search under our name. But we've had a couple times where we've put bonus content up. So yeah, that Tiff coming close to joining a cult is definitely going to be when we do the cult episode. We might have to do it sooner rather than later because I'm really intrigued now.
Oh, I did stupid things when I was in college. I was not very good at the whole listening to, don't talk to strangers, don't follow strangers that give you free things.
Well, you should have listened to fairy tales and not followed Pied Pipers and not eaten candy houses.
Mm-hmm. I should have, but I didn't. And now we're here and I have interesting stories to tell.
Exactly. Anyway, we digress. This is the end of the episode. We hope you've enjoyed.
This is where the catchphrase goes.
And bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast. And on Instagram at You Totally Made That Up. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.